Hello, fellow foodies. Are you ready for the 19th episode of Foodie Pharmacology? I have a super special guest for this episode. I first met Chef Sean Sherman about a year ago at the Society for Economic Botany meeting that was held in Madison, Wisconsin. I was simply wowed by his moving plenary lecture on the importance of understanding indigenous foodways to rebuild health and integrity in indigenous communities. I was also blown away by his delicious cooking. You see, he and his team catered the final banquet, which was a veritable feast of indigenous foods, including many different botanical ingredients that kept his audience of ethnobotanists hungry for more of each dish as it was revealed. Since then, Chef Sean has been busy at work on some exciting initiatives that we're going to discuss today. So let's begin first by learning a bit more about one of his favorite indigenous food ingredients, Labrador tea. The common name of Labrador tea actually refers to three closely related plant species. There is Rhododendron tomentosum, also known as Northern Labrador tea, Rhododendron grenlandicum, also known as Bog Labrador tea, and Rhododendron neoglandulosum, known as Western Labrador tea. All of these were formerly in the genus Latum, but now are under Rhododendron. These all belong to the Ericaceae, or heath family. This is the same family, by the way, where we find blueberries, bilberries, and cranberries. These three species have a long history of use as a tea and flavoring ingredient by Native American and First Nations peoples. On this episode, we're going to focus on Rhododendron tomentosum, also known by its botanical synonym of Latum palustre. Besides its common name of Northern Labrador tea, some folks may also know this species as Marsh Labrador tea or even as Wild Rosemary or Marsh Rosemary, although it is not actually in the same botanical family as rosemary. I'll refer to it as Labrador tea throughout the show. Labrador tea is a richly fragrant plant that grows as a short herb of up to 50 centimeters in height. And like rosemary, it has evergreen leaves. Its flowers emit a strong aroma that attracts bees and other pollinators. And it grows in northern latitudes across North America and in the north of Europe and Asia. Its preferred habitat includes peaty soils, bogs, heaths, and wet pine forests. The medicinal uses of Labrador tea date back in records to at least the 18th century. Historically, it was used to treat ailments like insect bites, colds, coughs, and rheumatism. Besides its medicinal uses, it is also well known for its intense fragrance, which can cause headaches in some individuals. In Europe and Asia, the plant was used in folk medicine for bronchitis, lung afflictions, wounds, sore throat, colds, fever, pain, dysentery, and even leprosy. It was also used as an insect repellent, and in the country of Estonia, whole dried herbs were actually hung in closets or placed in bedding to deter bedbugs. The Sami people of Norway used decoctions of this plant for the treatment of whooping cough and rheumatism. In North America, a specific subspecies known as Rhododendron tomentosum subspecies subarcticum, which is also known under the synonym of Latum palustre subspecies decumbens, was one of the most popular medicinal plants used by First Nations people. For example, the Inuit and Cree people used the plant to treat a wide variety of ailments, including respiratory afflictions like colds, coughs, sore throat, shallow breathing, and tuberculosis. They also used it to treat conditions of pain, like headache, toothache, rheumatism, inflammations, heart and chest pain. Lastly, they use it to treat infections, foot sores, and stomach ache. Labrador tea was identified in a recent scientific study to be a good candidate for culturally appropriate anti-diabetes therapy for these populations. Still today, besides its many medicinal applications, Labrador tea is also valued as a tea used for general consumption by many First Nations people. Interestingly, across parts of Asia, where this same subspecies can be found in the wild, it was also applied in very similar medicinal contexts. For example, in China, they used the leaves to treat infection and inflammation. In Korea, it was used to treat ailments of women's health. And in Tibetan medicine, it was used as a decoction or infusion to treat bronchitis, liver disease, tuberculosis, and as a bath for women's health and gynecological afflictions. Most of the scientific literature concerning the chemical makeup of Labrador tea is focused on its essential oil, which is a concentrated preparation of aromatic compounds found in the highly resinous plant. The essential oil of Labrador tea is composed of around 90 unique compounds, and the major components are the oxygenated sesquiterpenoids known as ladol, palustrol, and cyclochlorinone. Other major constituents include myrcene, cymene, and limonene. As with all other studies on plant essential oils, the composition of the mixture of compounds in a species is heavily influenced by the location where the plant grows, as plants respond to climatic and environmental conditions and stressors through the production of these secondary metabolites. Other compounds found in polyphenolic fractions of the plant include hydroxycinnamic acids, flavonoids, coumarins, and a number of triterpenoids. Many scientific studies have examined the biological properties of extracts derived from Labrador tea, and these have demonstrated promising anti-inflammatory and analgesic or pain-relieving effects. They have also shown promising antimicrobial properties against pathogenic fungi and viruses. There are also studies showing anti-diabetic properties, antioxidant action, and insecticidal activities. Of note, many of these observed activities are in line with the traditional uses of the plant in traditional medicine practices. Now, the question of toxicology, however, remains a point of concern in the literature. The sesquiterpenoid compound known as ladol, which is found in the plant essential oil, can actually impact the central nervous system, causing psychomotor stimulation, and at high doses can even cause symptoms of seizure, paralysis, breathing problems, and even death in extreme cases. These serious adverse reactions are associated with overdosage of ladol. However, regarding the use of Labrador tea as a medicinal or general beverage, ladol found in low concentrations in the beverage are thought to yield restorative or stimulating actions similar to that of caffeine. Remember, caffeine in high doses can also lead to similar central nervous system adverse effects, so ladol is not unique in this aspect. It all comes down to the dose. Many factors can impact the levels of ladol in the final beverage product, and this includes the subspecies used to make the beverage, the means of preparing the beverage, such as hot versus cold brew, and the environment where the plant is collected. Based on what has been reported in the literature and the long history of safe use of Labrador tea by indigenous populations across North America, Europe, and Asia as a medicinal beverage, the use of appropriate and non-excessive levels of the tea is recommended. In future studies, I'd love to see more research done on the safety and medicinal benefits of the actual traditional preparation of Labrador tea rather than on super concentrated essential oils, which exceed all dose values for typical use in traditional systems of medicine. Before we dive into the interview with Chef Sean to discuss this fascinating ingredient and his work in indigenous foodways, let me give him a full introduction. Chef Sean Sherman is Oglala Lakota and was born in Pine Ridge, South Dakota. Chef Sean has been cooking across the U.S. and Mexico over the past 30 years and has become renowned nationally and internationally in the culinary movement of indigenous foods. His main focus has been on the revitalization and evolution of indigenous food systems throughout North America. Chef Sean has studied on his own extensively to determine the foundations of these food systems to gain a full understanding of bringing back a sense of Native American cuisine to today's world. In 2014, he opened the business titled The Sous Chef as a caterer and food educator in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. He and his business partner, Dana Thompson, also designed and opened the Tatanka truck, which featured pre-contact foods of the Dakota and Minnesota territories. In October of 2017, Sean was able to perform the first decolonized dinner at the James Beard House in Manhattan along with his team. His first book, The Sioux Chef's Indigenous Kitchen, was awarded the James Beard Medal for Best American Cookbook in 2018 and was chosen as one of the top 10 cookbooks of 2017 by the LA Times, San Francisco Chronicle, as well as the Smithsonian Magazine. This year, Chef Sean was selected as a Bush Fellow, as well as receiving the 2019 Leadership Award by the James Beard Foundation. The Sioux Chef team of 12 people continues with their mission to help educate and make Indigenous foods more accessible to as many communities as possible through the recently founded nonprofit North American Traditional Indigenous Food Systems, or NATIFS. Thanks so much, Sean, for coming on the show. It's, like I mentioned before, it was such an honor to hear you speak at the Society for Economic Botany meeting last year, and I loved your cooking on top of that, and I've been following your work and all the cool things that you've been doing, not only in cuisine, but also in kind of outreach and activism and raising awareness around Indigenous food. So it's super awesome to have you on Foodie Pharmacology.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Thanks. So as we prep for the show, I asked you to select a plant ingredient that really represented the work that you do with Indigenous foodways. And can you tell us what really led you to pick Labrador tea and what stands out about it to you?
So I thought that would be a fun one just because where we are in Minnesota, it's so widely available. And every year I've been able to get out and harvest like bags of it, basically, you know, knowing where some of these huge draws of it are growing. And it's something that I also saw a connection with way out in Northern California. I have an aunt that's a Yurok, and they were harvesting it way out that way. And just coming across so many tribes that are so familiar with it. And I feel like it's just something that isn't talked about that much, you know, but, you know, we know it as a swamp tea in a lot of tribal communities. And it's something that, you know, a lot of the elders really light up about when we bring it around. So I thought it'd just be a fun one to have a conversation about.
That's great. So one thing that I noted in my research on this plant is that it really is one of the most important plants among First Nations peoples as well, and not only for medicinal purposes, but also, as you mentioned, just as a tea that's enjoyed by a number of different groups. And what's your earliest memory of having this tea?
You know, I came across it the first time, actually. It wasn't until I moved to Minnesota, which would have been right after college for me. That's when I first discovered it. And it's just been around ever since then. It was something that I was able to identify right away. So I moved to Minnesota in the mid late 90s. And I was working in the Black Hills in Spearfish, South Dakota before that. And I'd been primarily working in restaurants, but I worked the Forest Service for a couple of years. And my job as an entry-level Forest Service person was just a field surveyor. So I just had to go out in the hills and, you know, go to certain map spots and identify plants. But that skill really was something that was so much fun for me because it obviously came in really handy later in life with this focus on Indigenous foods and really connecting with the plants outdoors and realizing there's, you know, the value of so many of these plants out there. So I think exploring Minnesota from the times of my, you know, 20s onward has been, you know, such an amazing place to be because it's obviously very different from the Black Hills, even though you find some similarities here and there. But something like Labrador tea is always a pleasure to come across when you're out there in the woods.
Yeah, it's kind of like a scavenger hunt, right, when you find those really fun ingredients. And I think that's what draws me really to your work is you clearly have a love for botany in everything that you do from your cooking and also your ingredient educational outreach. So I guess one other question I had was, when you think about the history of Indigenous foodways and plants like Labrador tea, have these traditions been lost or are they still really prevalent? Or where do you see things right now?
It's a bit of a mix, you know. So when I first started the work that I'm doing now as a chef, it was really having this realization because I grew up on Pine Ridge Community and in South Dakota, and I'm enrolled with the Oglala Lakota Sioux Tribe. And as a chef, I had studied so many different cuisines from around the world. And, you know, Minneapolis was a nice food scene and there was restaurants from all over the world. And then it was just that realization of the absence of indigenous foods, of just realizing that even though I could find foods from all over the world, there was nothing that represented the land I was actually standing on. And it was really eye-opening for me to even realize as a chef, and I had learned so much about cooking from so many different cultures and really knew so little about my own. So it really shot me on a path to not only understand what were indigenous foods and indigenous food systems, but also what happened to that knowledge and why wasn't it handed down to me, because it hadn't been that long in history. I look at my own family history, and like I was born in 1974. And 100 years before my birth in 1874, the Lakota were still living on the plains as they always had, because they hadn't even discovered the gold in the Black Hills until 1876. So much had been lost in such a short period of time. For me, it was just a huge study of the history of what happened to Indigenous peoples and the U.S. government, and, you know, just the destruction of so much natural food ways, just environment in general with mass deforestation and loss of so many different kinds of animals, and the history of colonization in general when it comes down to it. But on top of that, also realizing the loss of our knowledge and our education. So part of this work was identifying what is Indigenous education. And just knowing that it was basically thousands of years and generations of knowledge being handed down family member after family member, primarily how to live sustainably utilizing mostly plant knowledge when it came down to it, for food, for medicine, for crafting, and for basically everything. So for me, it was just trying to get see that first, and then as I've been able to travel around the United States and parts of Canada and Mexico and visit so many different Indigenous communities, and to see varying states of where Indigenous culture is left alive or almost completely wiped away, but realizing that we could regain a lot of it through this knowledge, and a lot of it starts with that knowledge of plants.
Yeah. Well, and as an ethnobotanist in the field of ethnobotany, we put a lot of effort into documenting what is remaining of plant knowledge, and you have these massive plant lists that are made. But I think one thing that is missing in kind of the scientific endeavors of the field are exactly what you're doing in, you know, reclaiming that knowledge and reconnecting with people using that knowledge. And that's so important. I mean, documenting the knowledge is key as well, but really putting that into use and practice is the best way to keep it alive, in my opinion. What has been the response from different age groups? I mean, I wonder about, are children really interested in this? Is this something the elders are really drawn to? Or, you know, what has your experience been with different age groups in this work?
Yeah, we've been able to work with pretty much all age groups, you know, from super young children, kindergarten age, all the way up into elders. And, you know, it's, of course, across the board, but people are really excited, I think, in general, especially, you know, a lot of the times we'll do one of these big dinners for a tribal community reintroduce them to some of these foods and flavors in the style that they just haven't had around for such a long time. And a lot of the elders will remember their grandparents utilizing a lot of these flavors and these techniques. And it really touches something special, and it's really pretty amazing to be around that, because the elders will light up with all of these memories that they're just so happy to share, that this food unlocked for them for the first time, some of these flavors. And they'll have these memories like, oh, you know, we used to go out and harvest this in the forest with my grandparents. Like back then, the trails used to be so clear. We knew where all the different patches of food were. And today everything is so grown over. So, but anyways, it's just so amazing to hear those stories. And plus they'd say stuff like, oh, we'd swim out to this island and we'd harvest all these plants and then bring them back. And, you know, they just had forgotten about these flavors because nobody had been utilizing for such a long time. And then they get really excited to share those stories with the children around them at these dinners, you know. So it's this food sets off so much like just memory and passion. And it's really amazing to witness that so consistently as we go to these tribal communities.
Yeah, and so much of the cultural heritage, too, I think, is tied to food. I'm sure there are different songs and rituals and gatherings, specific gatherings that are specific to certain types of foods. And when they're harvested, that also is probably tied to those memories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's just seeing like all of this amazing, you see those commonalities of how close a connection that the indigenous peoples had to the landscape and how they set themselves to be a part of the ecosystem and not above it. And that everything they do, they're very watchful of. So any chain breaks around the ecosystem, they know it's going to have lasting effects to many other things around it, right? Because we look at this very colonial pyramid chain of how things work, of where we have men on top and other men below that, and then all the other animals and everything else below that, you know? So, but it's obviously not the way of nature, because we're all part of nature. Exactly. So it's really, I think it's really eye-opening for people who don't have a lot of knowledge of indigenous community and culture to see how deeply connected indigenous peoples are, and how they've been able to maintain and carry that sensibility with them, despite all of this oppression and drastic change and cultural trauma that's happened to a lot of these communities. So for us, it made it even more important to find a manner and a path to be able to get this back out there in real time, in today's time, and to show how doable this is, you know. So that's kind of how we developed the work that we're doing now with our nonprofit and trying to be a center for indigenous, a center and resource for indigenous education and knowledge centered around food, and to create a system that we can share and grow and help revitalize many communities, as many as we can, as fast as we can.
That's great. And I think what you're doing really illustrates, too, the importance of food sovereignty. I mean, there are certain terms in the kind of global food research area where you have food security, which is access to adequate food, right? And then food sovereignty is really access to food that is culturally appropriate and nutritious. And I think this is what you're really tapping into. And with Labrador tea, what was interesting in the research I did was that there was also a study that looked at the anti-diabetic properties of the tea and how, you know, this was something that could be used for diabetes prevention, or was used in that way historically, and could be, again, another aspect of food sovereignty to be integrated into the diet. So very cool.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that there is this movement of indigenous food sovereignty happening not only in the U.S., but kind of on a global scale. And it's been really great for us. And the timing has been really great for us, too, to be able to discover a path and how to be a major role in this movement. But, you know, it's not just us out there, because there's so many academics and ethnobotanists and seed keepers and farmers and growers and chefs, of course. And it all ties together with this just huge push for regaining this knowledge and implementing it into tribal communities. And we really feel like we can really help tribal communities become role models for areas around the globe to be able to tap back into their ancestral knowledge and to really become a part of nature and to celebrate not only bio and eco and plant diversity around them, but also really see how to celebrate cultural diversity. And, you know, we just see this amazing future of eventually being able to drive across North America or anywhere and be able to stop at indigenous community restaurants and experience the immense amount of diversity and celebrating that instead of, you know, trying to build walls and borders around things or trying to integrate diversity into who we are for the future.
Yeah. And well, and I think something you just said too about the diversity of seed keepers. And I think most people don't commonly keep seeds from their gardens, or many people don't actually have gardens any longer, but trade of seeds and really the keepers of that really genetic information, genetic biodiversity that we have in different crops and cultivars, is something that was extensively shared and traded across indigenous groups across the U.S. and obviously globally. And this is something that you don't see as often anymore. Can you tell us a bit more about what the nonprofit organization, how do you pronounce it? Is it Natifs?
Natifs.
Okay, cool. Natifs, yeah. Or the North American Traditional Indigenous Food Systems Group. Tell me a little bit more about what the nonprofit is doing to support these kind of activities of supporting training and food identification, gathering, cultivation, seed keeping, these kind of initiatives?
Well, we saw probably the biggest issue was that we wanted to do more, number one, than just open up one restaurant in Minneapolis where we're based at. We wanted to be able to figure out how to do this everywhere because we saw the need for it all over the place, obviously, you know, because still today you have, you know, giant food capitals of the world like New York and Chicago and LA, and there are zero Native American restaurants in those cities, which is kind of insane, right?
Yeah, that is insane.
So we wanted to figure out how can we change that, and how, and you know, part of it was understanding the history of colonialism, of course, and how Indigenous peoples haven't had the entitlement to have rich parents to start small businesses to thrive and to grow things out and stuff like that. So it's a matter of like, but you know, again, the biggest piece was the loss of our education and you know, what happened after boarding schools and residential schools and how damaging that was. So for us, we saw food access, of course, was one big piece. But on top of that, food education and access to that education was missing too. So we developed NATIFS, which is the acronym for North American Traditional Indigenous Food Systems, to make that change. So we're opening up a unit here in Minneapolis this next spring called the Indigenous Food Lab. And the Indigenous Food Lab is a nonprofit restaurant. It's part of our 501c3. And it's a place where people will be able to come and experience the food in real time, just like a regular restaurant. Mm-hmm. But on top of that, we're utilizing it as a space where people can come and take classes and learn about Indigenous education, and for us to have a research and development team to be able to develop more curriculum and become a resource for Indigenous food education, and do this on a large scale so people can tap into it. So our vision is that we will have this educational component and being able to develop a lot of curriculum, or a lot of there'll be a lot of calendared classes for people to come and take classes on everything, and whether it's Native American agriculture and seed saving, or ethnobotany and wild food and plant identification and harvesting, or cooking and culinary of all sorts, food preservation, nutrition, health. And, you know, there's so much we can be teaching about. But also we want to be able to bring in groups from different regions and be able to let them explore through kind of workshops and give them kind of accessible and modular educational tracks that we can help develop for them. So whether it's nutritionists coming in from tribes or tribal leaders or professional chefs, that we'll be able to develop something for them that they can really take home. But our goal is to really work with the tribal communities in our nearby vicinity and help them to develop. We want to help them to develop some kind of healthy food entity that is particular to their tribe, their region, their history, their language. And the flavors around them, and utilizing ourselves as support, as development, as training and education. So they would send whoever whoever community members would be running those operations, and we'd be able to completely train them on all aspects of that. And it could be something as small as just a catering operation, or it could be as large as a full-scale restaurant, depending on what the tribe has the capacity for. And then being able to grow that. So we see this network of food access happening around us in the tribal communities and being impactful that way, and hopefully influencing them to grow out community gardens and to gain the knowledge to bring in more wild foods and wild plants around them, and to push that food diversity in their diets like their ancestors used to have it, and even pushing them for permaculture design and just landscaping with purpose and creating more like food orchards in their community.
So we see that being my ears.
So we see that being really obviously impactful for them, right? And just being a support system, creating a support system. So then our goal is to mimic that and open up Indigenous food labs in cities all across North America. And each one could be a regional center point to train and develop and support those tribal communities in their regions. So whether we're in Seattle or San Francisco or Chicago or Albuquerque or Charleston or New York, anywhere, we could place an Indigenous food lab in those cities and then just be able to expand and develop around them. And we're not particular to any of the colonial borders, so we could be throughout Canada, obviously Alaska, down in Mexico, and ideally down the road, grow this out on a global scale.
That's amazing. I mean, I can just see how this vision could transform into something that's sustainable and long lasting, because you're building not just, you know, the gardens, you're building the entire infrastructure and supporting that growth out and sharing of knowledge. I mean, you mentioned earlier boarding schools, and I just want to make sure that the audience understands what that meant and what that did to traditional systems of knowledge and the transfer of knowledge.
Sure. So boarding schools were started in the late 1800s. The first one was in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. It was developed by an officer. His name was Richard Pratt. He's quoted for saying, "Kill the Indian, save the man." Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have seen photos of these young Indian children in their regular outfits. And then standing next to him would be another picture of themselves in like a school outfit, you know, so they could see this transformation happening of these school children. But it was actually extremely damaging, of course, because what's happening is just a continuation of ethnic cleansing, in a sense, on an educational and personal level. We see these military schools being really damaging because instead of these kids who should have been learning all of their indigenous knowledge and education that should have been passed down to them, are instead being forced to speak English and learn religions that aren't theirs, and to learn a lot of trade skills like and servitude skills like carpentry and housekeeping and sewing and things like that. And because these are military schools and these kids were forced to be there, they were extremely harsh, and corporal punishment was used extremely heavily, which was something that tribal communities didn't have before. Yeah. So like tribal communities before that, you know, corporal punishment was not a way of parenting. You know, they didn't, they had immense respect for elders and for children, and they would never even think about like beating their kids. But because of these boarding schools and this really harsh environment, they bring a lot of this trauma home with them, and it creates kind of an intense cycle that still is happening, and we're still seeing it today. With a lot of domestic abuse and sexual abuse and things like that, that stemmed from this traumatic experience of these people in these boarding schools. And, you know, Canada had the same system, which they called residential schools, but those were still alive up until the 1990s. So there's plenty of people still alive today that went through boarding school systems and residential school systems and know a lot about these really harsh environments that these poor kids had to deal with. Not by choice, obviously.
Yeah, they were. I mean, they were basically kidnapped from their families and forced to give up their language and their culture and techniques. And so, you know, that had huge destructive impact on traditional knowledge and knowledge of food systems, and which is again what makes this kind of initiative so incredibly meaningful, is to reclaim that. And I think another thing that's important for the audience to know is that different indigenous groups have different languages, and they had different foods they were eating. They had different types of cuisine, different, you know, various differing cultures. There's not a unified one culture for Native American or First Nation. I think that's important to recognize the diversity of flavor and culture that was there. Yeah. So throughout this work and this journey, I guess, what's been the most surprising moment or experience for you?
Probably just how much there is to learn, you know, realizing that I tapped into something where I will never see the end of it, you know, in my lifetime. There's way too much to learn, because, you know, there's so much to learn with just one region compared to like looking at North America as a whole and all the immense cultural diversity that's out there. And there's just so much to take in. But it was really trying to build a system that can absorb that and to become a center point for people to tap into. Because it's something that we're in danger of losing, you know. I look at Mexico today, where there's still so much indigenous culture still alive, and how like even Mexican food in general is more indigenous than the Spanish or French, because they're utilizing a lot of the nixtamalized corn products and the chilies and things like that. And if you decolonize those plates, then you just lose cheese and sour cream and pork and things like that, of course. But overall, like Mexican food, if you decolonize it, is still largely Mexican food, right?
Yeah.
But we're looking at how this generation is in danger of losing that, losing an immense amount of that knowledge, just like we did in the U.S. and parts of Canada. because these younger generations aren't seeing the value of why should they grow these corns that their grandmothers are growing and take the time to like nixtamalize it and make their own tortillas when they can just walk down to the mercado and buy some, you know. So, you know, all this work that we're doing, actually, our plan is to develop this education in both Spanish and English to use both those colonial languages to help preserve a lot of this indigenous culture. Because we just feel like it's going to be really important to be able to, you know, really reach out on a larger scale. But there's just so much to learn. And I think people should be excited that, especially, you know, depending on where, whatever, you know, your focus is, if it's plants, if it's farming and seeds, or if it's food, like there's just so much. And it's just an exciting time to be an indigenous person right now.
That's amazing. And you mentioned this term of decolonizing the plate. And I was wondering, what are some of the main things that you remove from the menu when you're thinking about a decolonized meal? You mentioned pork that came over with Europeans. What other ingredients would you remove?
So when we started our, when I started my company and business and the, I officially started working for myself in 2014, and kind of, it was a challenge of how do you cook regional, seasonal, indigenous foods and cut out pre-colonial or cut out colonial and foods that came from reservations and things like that. So right off the bat, we removed dairy, wheat flour, cane sugar, beef, pork, and chicken. And there's other, like tons of other pieces, of course, because we're not using black pepper. We're not using olive oil or balsamic vinegar or things like that, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but primarily, like, you know, just removing dairy and wheat flour and sugar was a huge part of it.
Well, these are all and just like pro-inflammatory foods too.
Totally, right? And like every diet out there is trying to mimic this indigenous diet that was already alive, you know.
Yeah.
So for us, it was just that challenge and, you know, creating tons of food around that. So like when we did the cookbook, the Sous Chef's Indigenous Kitchen, you know, we just showcased over 100 recipes using only indigenous foods and how we did it in our region and how we, you know, we tried to make it kind of an intro book that was safe for people to try. But just to think about the plant diversity that's literally outside their back door, and you know, how much more they can explore with food and flavor and health if they started to learn the plants and the history around them.
Yeah, and I think there are just so many interesting ways to use these wild foods. I think what's always surprising to me is that, you know, you can take things like, for example, cattails. Like, mm-hmm. If one looks at a cattail, and, you know, these are plants that like to grow around ponds, and I grew up in South Florida, so there are lots of cattails around. I never as a kid thought, I can eat that. But you absolutely can. And can you just use cattails as an example? Like, how would one eat cattail? And yeah.
Well, my favorite part of the cattail is just getting them at the beginning of the summer. Probably till midsummer when they're still pretty tender. So when they just pop up, you know, you just like pull them out and, you know, that stalk part from like pretty much the water and maybe a foot and a half up from there. But you just get pure vegetable on the inside. You just like peel it off like a leek almost. And on the inside and the heart of it, it's just like pure cucumber, basically. You know, it's so watery and juicy. You can just slice it raw and put it all over salads and stuff like that. And it's a little mucilaginous, so it can be a little slimy, but it's not much different than like okra, but I don't think it's as slimy as okra. If you try to cook it, it's going to be, but I think fresh, it tastes just like cucumber and it's so good. You know, but you just have to be careful, of course, where the water source is that you're pulling it from. So.
Oh, yeah. Because
they like to suck up all of the bad stuff, which is also good for the environment. But
Well, you know, I do a lot of field work with students, even here in the Southeast, and it always surprises me how reluctant they are to eat anything from the wild, even if it's a like planted tree, like mulberry. You know, go up to mulberry, they're like, oh, is this going to kill me? I'm like, what? No. There's this fear, I think, that people have because of this lack of knowledge around what is safe. I think as kids, we're often taught, you know, don't touch those berries. Those are poisonous. Those will kill you. You know, and you just have this mantra of if you don't know it, avoid it. And because it's not being taught, there's just this underlying fear of things out there. And, you know, same with mushrooms. We had an amazing week last summer where it rained heavily and there was just bucket loads of chanterelle mushrooms
that
we were able to harvest. I mean, you should never collect mushrooms unless you know what you're doing, obviously. But oh my gosh, these were fabulous, and we had the most amazing meal of just, you know, fresh harvested chanterelles with a little bit of butter and garlic, and it was amazing. But that was obviously a super new experience for all of those students. They'd never done anything like that again. So I can imagine that in your work with the restaurant and the teaching components of natives, that you must have people that are just in awe of, oh wow, I can do this. <It's>
like... Yeah, I mean, I think it's just, we're just trying to open up people's minds, and it's great that I get to be able to go out and talk about this work a lot and get in front of many different kinds of demographics, you know, so lots of native communities, lots of university communities, and just towns in general, and cities, and culinary conferences and things, but just to bring this perspective out there. And it's really great to see so many people open up about all these possibilities that they just didn't ever really think about, you know? So for us, there's just like, there's so much to explore out there. So why wouldn't you? And, you know, this food has so many different cool properties, and I probably have a bad habit of tasting tons of plants that I probably, you know, should research more before I just eat them. But I just, you know, you're out there in the woods like, oh, this looks interesting. It's, you know, and it's a little taste and see and things like that. So, I don't know. There's so much out there. So, I mean, every year we're learning new plants, and, you know, you hear a lot of these stories of people like, oh, don't eat that because it's poisonous. But a lot of times, like indigenous peoples, because they had thousands of generations of figuring out how to work with these plants, exactly. You know, knew about these medicinal properties. And some of these plants that, you know, especially a lot of the Europeans were calling poisonous, were just really strong medicines. And mm-hmm. It was just not knowing how to utilize them properly. So there's a lot to learn from indigenous medicinal perspectives, for sure.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm just thinking of other examples in our research where the way that you prepare a plant can have huge impact on its chemistry. And what that translates to is it has impact on its flavor, has impact on its pharmacological properties, you know. It's not just knowledge of the ingredient, but also when it's harvested, like you mentioned, certain things you want to harvest when they're very young, and then how it's prepared. I love the example of, I don't know if you've ever had poke salad, which is Phytolacca americana, and it's, you harvest it only in the early spring when the leaves are very young and fresh. And you have to boil it and toss out the water 3 times because it's poisonous. But if you deactivate that poisonous component through boiling and dumping the water, then it's fine to eat, you know. So, but you would never want to eat it as a mature plant because then the levels of the toxin are much higher. But it's those details that are really key.
And how to handle or just like ingredients. I think nettles is an easy example too for people to get, right? Because everybody knows about stinging nettles, but it's as simple as just steaming them, or, you know, throwing them in some hot water for a second, and then they're totally fine, and they're super nutritious at that point in time. Yeah. You know, do whatever you want to with them, and they're in cuisines all over the world, obviously. So
yeah, no, I love nettle tea, and I love I've even had it kind of as like a spinach almost, you know, just kind of sauteed with, it's so good.
Yeah, it's so good. And it's just like the poke salad, like you're saying too, like, you know, once you just harvest it and saute it, like you can do whatever you want to with it. It's a green. You can re-dry it and put it back into soups later if you want to. So,
yeah, it's really cool. So on the topic again of Labrador tea, to wrap up the episode, how do you collect it and how do you prepare it and what does it taste like?
I think it's got such an amazing aroma when you're harvesting it fresh. You know, it's just like almost a citronella like aroma. And I've even noticed like out there, because usually it's growing in kind of a swampy area, you know, I would see huge draws of it and just be harvesting tons, because like miles of it growing and being able to just harvest as much as I could. But noticing that, like, the more of that oil I got on me, the less the mosquitoes would get at me. So there's got to be some kind of correlation that I've never really studied too much.
No,
but it seems like a thing. Like, I would just like rub some of it on my skin, and then I would just, you know, it would like be like a protective something. So
it totally has. Actually, it has insect repellent activities or traditional use as an insect repellent in a number of different groups. Yeah.
Yeah, I noticed that right away. So I just think it's so cool because of that, you know.
Yeah.
But the flavor is amazing, especially when it's super fresh. But it, you know, it kind of has a more of a almost like a green tea flavor as it dries out, and you can just keep it. But we've done all sorts of stuff because we like made broths with it, just simple broths where we'd like maybe have some smoked fish and some wild vegetables and greens, and then you'd pour over kind of a sweetened, like maple sweetened Labrador broth on top of the fish, and just give it a bunch of flavor. But, you know, we've ground it up and mixed it into seasoning, and we've put it in all sorts of stuff. So, I mean, for us, like once we have the ingredient, we can do whatever we want to with it when it comes to playing with the culinary, because, you know, our focus was more on the creation and understanding of indigenous, well, more of understanding the indigenous pantry first. And then from that point, we were able to have pretty much license to create whatever we want to. And I think it's just so exciting to think about all the different creativity pieces that we can come up with for the future. And you know, giving indigenous peoples, you know, this future, being able to just be able to grow modern indigenous foods into such an amazing direction. You know, it's great to learn traditional recipes and what people have done with it in the past, but our focus wasn't trying to recreate something from, you know, the 1600s or 1491. And it was more about just understanding that knowledge, as much knowledge as the past as possible, and applying it to where we are today, and to be able to grow out something that's just extremely beautiful, diverse, and healthy. You know, because we're only serving healthy food doing this indigenous diet. That's just the way it is. We're only cooking and serving healthy food.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think this is the new true American cuisine.
Yeah, it really is.
You know, wow. Well, thank you so much, Sean. This has been, as always, enlightening to like talk with you. And I'm going to keep an eye on all the cool things that you're doing. And yeah, I think I'm really excited
Come visit us.
Oh yeah, definitely will.
Come visit us. Sure. Yeah.
It'd be great to check out some of these, your new restaurant too. This is such a great concept. Awesome.
Oh, well,
thanks a bunch, Sean. I hope you enjoyed this special episode of Foodie Pharmacology. If you've been inspired as I have by Chef Sean and his team's work, you may want to consider making a donation to their newly founded nonprofit organization known as NATIFS, or the North American Traditional Indigenous Food Systems, spelled NATIFS. NATIFS is establishing an indigenous food lab in Minneapolis that will house an indigenous restaurant and training center covering all aspects of food service, research and development, indigenous food identification, gathering, cultivation, and preparation, and all components of starting and running a successful culinary business based around Native traditions and indigenous foods. Their mission is to promote indigenous foodways education and to facilitate indigenous food access. You can learn more about this exciting initiative at www.natifs.org. The website also includes a web link for donations in support of this mission. Next week on Foodie Pharmacology, we're going to take a deep dive into the science of cheese. I'll be speaking with Dr. Laura Sanchez, a professor at the University of Illinois Chicago, who is an expert in the field of mass spectrometry. She has begun some really innovative work using cheese as a model system to understand how bacteria and fungi in the cheese talk to one another using chemical signaling. Who knew so much chatter was happening in your cheddar? Tune in next time to learn more. I'm Dr. Cassandra Quave, and you've been listening to Foodie Pharmacology, the podcast for the food curious, recorded in Atlanta, Georgia, at the Emory Center for Digital Scholarship. You can subscribe to the podcast on SoundCloud or iTunes. And hey, while you're at those platforms, give us a hand and leave a review. That's an awesome way to help us reach more listeners. Also, if you've got a great idea for a future show, reach out to me. You can find me on our Foodie Pharmacology Facebook page, or on Twitter or Instagram at Quave Ethnobot, spelled Quaveethnobot. And I will see you next time.